At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. Whether your pursuit involves a bachelor's, master's, or doctoral degree, GCU's learning environments are designed for supportive networking and collaboration. With over 330 academic programs, GCU provides a path to help you fulfill your dreams. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
All rise.
Welcome to the Cyber Law and Business Report. Get the top story on the hot-button internet legal topics of the day. This is your home for the latest on internet law and policy. Hear the latest net trends impacting business and have your questions answered right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report. Now, please welcome your host, the founder of the Internet Law Center, Bennett Kelly.
Good morning. This is Bennett Kelly broadcasting live from the Internet Law Center here in downtown Santa Monica in the heart of Silicon Beach. Please be seated. We got a great show for you today. It's a beautiful sunny day here in California, but we know that's not the case. Some parts of the East Coast, which are being hit hard by the hurricane. So our prayers are with you. And today we're going to be talking about an important issue. We've already done one show on the whole competition for the Amazon second headquarters, as commonly referred to as HQ2. And the question that we're going to cover today is at what cost, you know, when does it make sense to invest and give the tax incentives that are required to lure an Amazon and Apple and Intel? And so our guest today, we're thrilled to have, is Greg LeRoy. He's the executive director of goodjobsfirst.org, and he's calling to us from Washington, D.C., I believe. Greg, are you with us?
I am, Bennett. Great to be with you.
Thank you for joining us. And so Greg caught my attention. He had co-authored a piece entitled, "Cities Need to Stop Selling Out to Big Tech Companies. There's a Better Way." And so I guess that wouldn't fall in that category of titles that don't tell you where the author is going. Yes, it appeared in Subtlety Monthly, and but it was very timely because it comes in the middle of the Amazon contest. And so what, tell us, well, first, why don't you tell us about goodjobsfirst.org, and sure, then we'll go into what led you to write the piece.
Sure. So Good Jobs First is a nonprofit, nonpartisan group that I founded almost exactly 20 years ago. And we're a watchdog group on these incentives, these corporate income tax, sales tax, property tax exemptions, discounts, rebates that states and cities give companies in the name of jobs. Some of the programs are well designed and some of them are really out of control. And sometimes these high stakes, you know, buffalo hunting sweepstakes like HQ2 really put the whole problem on steroids.
Let's address the buffalo hunting. I like the phrase, but it's really, you're talking about cities going for some prestige, something they can mount on a mantle and say, here, you know, Joe Voter, I did this for you. I brought this company or that company.
Right, exactly. And obviously, the more famous the company is, the more trophy value it has. So Amazon, being so high profile, being so consumer top rated, is the ultimate trophy prize or ultimate buffalo to land and mount. But Apple or Dell or Google or Facebook, they're all in the game these days.
Right. And we often see this, you know, publicly reported in terms of sports franchises. But, you know, these days there's also a lot of money being given away to companies that, you know, bring jobs to or keep jobs within a state.
Right. So, I mean, there's really kind of an 80-year history to this whole subsidy industrial complex or whatever you want to call it. But it really ramped up after the war and after the interstate highway system started getting built in the late 50s and 60s. So that, you know, 42 years ago, Business Week magazine coined the phrase second war among the states. That is, states, you know, actively poaching jobs from each other, actively designing incentive programs intended to induce companies to relocate. And we've been in that war ever since. We really don't have any federal leadership trying to rein things in.
And, you know, as I'm by way of background, I'm a New Englander. And so, you know, when I was growing up, a lot of jobs had recently left and gone to the South.
Yep.
And North Carolina being a prominent one. And you know, textiles in particular. And now, you know, I understand, you know, that allowed their economy to grow. And then those jobs went somewhere else, whether it was Mexico or China. So it is an ongoing enterprise. Now, you refer to what is known as big ticket mega deals. Tell us what exactly that is.
Sure. I mean, we sort of make the cutoff at $50 million or more per individual project. Most of them, we've identified about 400 now in U.S. history. Most of them are in the hundreds of millions and even billions of dollars. And again, for one project, one microchip fabrication plant, one chemical factory, one auto assembly plant. And the tension here is, you know, too many eggs in one basket, or, you know, betting too many marbles on one project at the expense of everything else that might be supporting your local business base. That's the tension.
Yeah, and actually, I'm full disclosure, I'm a native of Rhode Island, and you know, we're going to talk a little bit about one of their failed attempt. But even before this one, I remember a project in the 70s where the governor actually was the company was Digital something. They may have just been called Digital. I just don't remember them, or if they're even if they're still around. But they actually built a freeway exit for this factory that they were going to build that never happened. And so, you know, it became a political embarrassment for the governor because here's his exit to nowhere.
Yep.
So I understand the concept. So we talked on the show with another show host here, Jim Hedger, about the Amazon HQ2 project. And I found it interesting in theory because there were two aspects to how Amazon was going to choose in terms of where to locate. One was a list of what they wanted the cities to have.
Right.
And on one level, it was all you could say it was kind of they were looking for what you might politically refer to as a progressive type city, one that had invested in their infrastructure, had diversity, you know, had a lot of things that one would associate with a, you know, a progressive city type or state politics. Mm-hmm. And so that was one level. And so the question, you know, and the second level though, were the tax incentives. And they were looking for incentives for them to locate there, and so I saw this competition being a dichotomy, a competition of two political schools of thought. One that, you know, tries to move action by tax incentives, the other that tries to create jobs through investment in infrastructure and by promoting a diverse, well-educated workforce. And, you know, so there was a little bit of both political stripes in play here. Mm-hmm. What was your reaction when you saw the RFP?
I think you're being very polite to say that that way. I mean, I think of it as Amazon wanting to have it both ways. That would be my way of putting it. That is, they want to not pay any property taxes or sales taxes on their machinery and equipment or income taxes, but they want great schools, great transit, great quality of life, great infrastructure, you know, great public systems, great law enforcement. And there is no such thing as a free lunch. I mean, that, and we've written a great deal about this competition. And we already know to some degree about some of the packages that were offered, right? They openly encouraged everybody to apply, including lots of places that didn't have a prayer, that didn't even meet that baseline list of requirements they set out about the size of the metro and the international
right.
air service and the graduate engineering schools and all the things they obviously need, any big high-tech company would need. But then they, you know, basically encouraged everybody to apply to gin up the pressure, and then they cut the list to 20 finalists, even though observers expected that, to maximize the pressure. We always suspected that they knew at least what their short list looked like before they ever launched the public auction. I mean, this is a company with such sophisticated consumer data analytics. and labor market. I mean, they're citing things all the time, right? They're citing data centers, they're citing warehouses. They're hiring more people per quarter than Facebook employs altogether. They know a great deal about where to put stuff in America because they do it constantly, and they're getting about 20 or so incentive deals a year for the facilities that they're putting up. So I think this, and they use the word incentives 21 times in that RFP, and otherwise the RFP was just kind of a, you know, kitchen sink catch-all laundry list of anything that you would obviously expect a company like them would need. So I suspect they knew what their short list was from the get-go. B, I think the exercise has really been engineered to get the maximum tax breaks, and C, they then want to have it both ways by having somebody else pay for great infrastructure, transit, schools, and quality of life.
Right.
That's what it looks like to us.
It's interesting. So highlight a couple of points you made. One about, you know, number of cities getting in that probably had no right to be in the mix. And I thought that was interesting. But what struck me as interesting were cities that had no right to be in the mix, you know, arguably, announcing that they didn't want Amazon. You know, it's kind of like, it's kind of like me here, telling Angela Jolie, sorry, I'm married. I don't think that was a pressing issue for her. But, you know, you saw cities like Little Rock make a public announcement saying, you know, we're happy with what we have, and we don't want to, you know, we get too busy here. So I thought that was well played for this, you know, for a couple of cities, because they got press out of it.
They did. And San Antonio did the same thing, and San Jose did it, although everybody said San Jose's, you know, pigging out right now on the new Googleplex there, so it was sort of no skin off their teeth. But, yes, those three places did get positive reactions to their saying thanks but no thanks.
But so to get to the heart of what you're saying, though, is, and even before this event, you were a critic of Amazon. In fact, your group put out a report in 2016 that said elected officials would best serve the public interest by telling Amazon no more deals. And what led you to reach that conclusion?
Sure. So it's really an analysis of the company's business plan. If you think back to when the company first started as a bookseller and then grew its, you know, its product base, its original business model revolved around having very few warehouses and locating them in places so that they could legally avoid so-called nexus, that is, the ability of a state to compel it to collect sales tax. So they locate, for instance, in the early years, they served the East Coast markets by putting warehouses in Delaware, which has no sales tax, and New Hampshire, which has no sales tax. And then they ship into the other states on the East Coast. But by shipping into those states and not actually having a warehouse in those states, they can avoid nexus. So they use the price advantage that they gained by having no sales tax collected to gain market share. Over time, of course, their business model morphed into Prime, right, and rapid delivery, two-day delivery, one-day delivery, same-day delivery. And as that evolution took place over the years, and it really started kicking in 2011, 2012, and finished playing out last year in 2017, they had to put warehouses everywhere. You can't have same-day delivery in Amarillo and not have a warehouse pretty close to Amarillo, et cetera. So they couldn't avoid having nexus, and they started caving and settling disputes they had with state sales tax departments and state treasurers and so on, often in exchange for getting incentive packages for the new warehouses they had to build. So our message to public officials was simple. We said the company must build gazillions of warehouses now. That's what their business model compels them to do. Don't pay them to do what they have to do anyway.
Right. And going into this competition, you obviously, you know, given that view of Amazon, you concluded that the HQ2 project, quote, can go down in history as a monument to high-tech arrogance and tax break favoritism.
Yeah, that's the real risk here. I think there's a lot of hubris in evidence in the way they began the auction. I think they were chastened. I think they were struck a little bit by how much blowback they got between September and January. And they really changed the whole way they were running the auction in January when they narrowed from 238 to 20. They went dark. They went back to the old school. No longer was it a public auction. They said, we don't want any publicity or coverage of our site visits. We don't want any disclosure of your next round bids. We're going to issue another second round RFP that's going to be covered by a non-disclosure agreement. And they've really kept a very low profile. And we think a lot of that has to do with the fact that so many people were upset by the very transparent nature of the grab they were staging starting in September.
So before we get into the substance, do you have an understanding as to who the front runners are right now? I saw some report that possibly Chicago and Miami had jumped into the front based on the fact that Amazon had done second visits to those two cities.
You know, I think the company's been throwing head fakes, and you know, one can get crazy trying to read into tea leaves, right? So Alexa was asked what's the weather going to be in Austin during the Amazon
right.
Super Bowl ad, right? And people said, "Oh, that's a signal." People here in the Washington D.C. area noticed that many people with Amazon URLs were reviewing a real estate listing in downtown Arlington, Virginia, and everybody concluded, "Oh, that must mean they're sizing up; they're ready to clinch the deal in Arlington." They made a charitable contribution recently to a school in Philadelphia, and everybody said, "Oh, what is it? That must be an advanced signal." I think this is a big company that's already doing a lot of business in a lot of labor markets, and I think they're enjoying watching people scramble with these little head fakes. But I will say publicly, the only city on the 20 list that I've never thought could be very competitive is Atlanta, because it's got such bad public transportation. It's so hard to take advantage of the labor market there because congestion is so awful. I do think that one or more of the project sites here in the D.C. area are likely to make the next cut, perhaps in combination. The two governors of Maryland and Virginia, the mayor of D.C., have already sent a letter to Bezos essentially saying they would not be upset if he were to sprinkle the project around the metro area here. I think other East Coast projects, sites like Philly and Newark, may be competitive as well. With Dallas, I've always thought was a very competitive project. But the other unknowable thing here, and this really goes to the core of Amazon, is we don't know what company this is going to be 10 years from now. We don't have any idea what Bezos is going to buy next, right? They've been on a big acquisitions binge. We don't know what they're going to grow next. And I think that with not being able to know that, we can't know like what he particularly needs. If he's going to become a big food processor, for example, Chicago would be a brilliant choice because that's become a big hub for corporate headquarters for food processing, with Conagra and ADM both relocating there in recent years, for example. But I doubt that, but that would make sense if he were, for example.
Right. You're pretty sure it won't be Little Rock?
I'm thinking that.
So with that, you know, with that kind of handicapping, I've always often heard Washington, D.C. is a front runner just because of, you know, what it has to offer and the fact that, you know, he has the Washington Post there as well. But there is one problem with this process. And that is, this is not a public process.
Right.
For example, the Chicago Tribune reported that Cook County had promised incentives in the ballpark of $2 billion.
Right.
And where was the debate over that?
Yeah, nowhere. I mean, that's the problem. We also put a study out examining how poorly disclosed were the 20 finalist bids. Of those 20, only two have been really fully disclosed.
Which Boston, two are those?
Boston and Toronto. And then another six have been partially disclosed or sort of broadly described. And we even put the Chicago bid in there because at least it had been price tagged, and we could tell from the outside which major incentive program was going to be involved. But, you know, many of the biggest ones, and a few others were public because they required enactments. So, for example, Maryland's has been through the legislature already, so we know the broad outlines of that one as well. But Pennsylvania's very secret. Both the cities of Pittsburgh and Philadelphia continue to thumb their nose at adverse rulings from the state open records office and refuse to disclose that bid. We don't know much about Columbus or Indianapolis or Atlanta, really. Despite the appearance of running a public auction, which is the way they started, it's actually a very secretive deal. You're right.
And then that's a public policy concern. I'd like to go into we talked a little bit about the costs of the HQ2 proposal. But we should also talk about the benefit. But first, I think we need to take a short break for our advertisers. You're listening to Cyber Law and Business Report only on webmasterradio.fm.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
Are you looking for the best in WordPress speed, security, and scalability? WP Engine is a digital experience platform for WordPress, powering digital experiences for large brands around the world. With easy-to-use site management tools and powerful do-it-your-way development features, WP Engine gives you the flexibility to build it your way. Improve your SEO and conversion rates with a faster site on WP Engine. Learn more on WPEngine.com.
Ready to do a podcast for your business? Make that podcast elevate to enterprise level. Let WebmasterRadio.fm expedite and execute your podcast to build your brand and broaden your customer base. WebmasterRadio.fm has worked with the world's biggest tech brands, Google, Yahoo, and Bing, and have worked with fast-growing brands like ShipStation and GoDaddy. Now it's your turn. Contact BRASCO at WMR.fm and rush your enterprise-level podcast into production at a very reasonable rate. Email BRASCO at WMR.fm.
WebmasterRadio.fm. Get addicted. Get ahead.
WebmasterRadio.fm. We're everywhere.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on WebmasterRadio.fm.
And we're back, and we're talking with Greg LeRoy about Amazon HQ2 and this, the general concept of cities basically trying to lure prestige tech companies, or any company for that matter, through tax subsidies and tax incentives. And before the break, we were talking, kind of handicapping the sweepstakes for Amazon HQ2, with both of us agreeing Little Rock was the front runner. And, but there are, in some defense of Amazon, there are huge economic benefits to having Amazon in your jurisdiction as a second headquarters.
Right, so that's the upside here. Obviously, they're talking about over time, 10, 15 years, as many as 50,000 headquarters employees making an average of $100,000 or better. Obviously, those would be big ripple effects, because you'd get both a lot of upstream purchasing power, business services, transportation services, consulting, utilities, things like that, as well as a lot of downstream ripple effects. That is, paychecks that good, people buy homes, people buy cars, people create a lot of other jobs. The other tension, though, that's come up as people have weighed the costs and benefits is the so-called Seattle effect. That is, the fact that no company is more dominant in a Class A office space market than Amazon is in Seattle. They've got about 20% of it, as I understand. And a lot of people say Amazon has more to do than anybody else with the very rapidly rising home prices in Seattle, the unusually large homeless population, and the general, housing affordability problem created by having so many people hired so quickly at such high wage levels, or salary levels. So the tension that a lot of community groups have raised in those 20 finalist cities is how to cushion the blow, how to make sure that the project doesn't displace incumbent residents at the expense of the newbies. Because, even especially in a tight labor market, but even in normal times, you'd guess studies would tell us that 80 or 85% of the job takers for a project like this won't be incumbent residents. There'll be people moving from outside the area. So the question is, well, if local residents are going to get less than a fifth of the jobs, and they're going to get higher housing prices, more traffic congestion, and crowded schools, well, how much can you like that? So that's the tension.
Right. And in this case, I mean, you've looked at Amazon's project elsewhere. In fact, you were very critical of their position in Ohio, where they located, was it data centers or was it shipping centers?
more warehouses. Yeah, several.
Yeah,
warehouses.
So they did warehouses, which they had to do for fulfillment, and mm-hmm. and granted, in those places, you know, Amazon had a disproportionate number of employees on food stamps. You know, give relative to the number, you know, its number of jobs it was providing. It was one of the top 10 or 15 employers in the state of Ohio that had employees on food stamps, even though it was like the 50th or 60th largest employer. But this project is different than a warehouse. This is going to be more higher paying jobs. So, you know, people are hoping for that ripple effect.
Yeah, absolutely. No, and that's also drives the site location decision, right? This is all about brain cells. It's not about real estate. It's not about, you know, grid connections. If you're going to hire 50,000 brainiacs, you've got to go to a place that already has quite a few corporate headquarters already, so you can grab some of them away from other companies. You've got to have some great graduate schools, not just in engineering, but law and accounting and marketing and other things like that. And you've got to have a quality of life that's good enough to attract people, right? Because if you expect to hire somebody and transfer them to the new city, the first question the family is going to ask is, how good are the schools? Can we afford the houses? How long is the commute going to be? As well, they should.
So going back to the broader topic of buffalo hunting, your report on big ticket deals, you know, highlights the problem with that, where you have states or localities going after the bigger employer, and in the process spending exorbitant amount of money on a per job basis. For example, Iowa, their data center with deal with Apple, could have cost per job as high as $4 million per job.
Right.
You mentioned in North Carolina had also did a data center deal with Apple that could be as much as $6.4 million per job.
Yeah.
And it's just how does that benefit the taxpayers?
Well, it doesn't, and that's the problem. Look, you know, to be intellectually honest here, there are certain kinds of projects that are extremely capital intensive, right? Certain kinds of manufacturing has become over time very capital intensive, like microchip fabrication, like chemical manufacturing and petrochemical processing, and now data centers, that is cloud computing centers, which are essentially rooms full of servers, you know, with a small number of people watching them and making sure and troubleshooting them once they're built. And so if you give a big tax break package to a place that employs just dozens of people, the cost per job is enormous. And we think, you know, obviously we don't think that these tax breaks are causing these data centers to get built, right? Everybody knows that the cloud is taking off. It's the way computing happens in America today. They've all got, there's hundreds of them out there, and there's hundreds more going to get built, no matter what, because that's the way YouTube stores your videos and Snapchat and everybody else. So we think the money would be much better spent at that rate, you know, on better schools, better roads, things that benefit lots of employers.
Now, I understand the data center issue because there was a point where in downtown Los Angeles during the crash of the dot-com crash, that real estate was so low in downtown LA just before the kind of boom from the moving the arena there, that a lot of the office space was leased up by data centers, and it was it was actually hurting downtown because those places don't have employees.
Right.
And so they weren't shopping at the stores, they weren't eating at the restaurants. And that a lot of downtown's renaissance came when those leases came up, and you know, it was no longer cheap to do so, and now downtown LA is doing better. So I understand that the challenge for that. But I remember once sitting down with a senator, and I don't know if I'm liberty to say who, but he was from a state that's one of the poorer states in the country, and we was with a bunch of tech people at the table, and he said, you know, it would be huge for us to land someone like Apple, or any tech company to open an office here or put some data center here, it would just be a signal to the rest of the country that we are open for business in this area. It's kind of planting the flag that locate in state X because we have Apple, we have Intel or whoever,
right?
And there's that sense that we chase the first one, but then that the second one we don't have to chase as hard.
And there can be merit to that. It really depends upon how the Buffalo fits into the bigger picture. That is, if you believe your state, your region, your metro area has a comparative advantage. So in the case of microchips or in data centers, if you have cheap electricity because you have hydropower, that gives you a comparative advantage to attract more of those, to make a cluster out of it, for example. If you've got a tech department, if you've got a computer sciences department in the university, turning out really smart people, and you'd like to keep them there and build companies around them. If you've got other comparative advantages in terms of quality of life and transportation access, or maybe you've already had a few startups that have prospered in your area and they have cumulatively begun to build your comparative advantage to attract companies like them, then my argument would be take those basics, whatever those basics are that are giving you that advantage, and strengthen them, but do it in a way where you're not putting a lot of eggs in any one basket. Keep investing in that graduate engineering school, keep improving on that quality of life, keep helping smaller companies with whatever it is they need, healthcare, quality control, export promotion. It always varies depending on who they are.
Right.
But that way you're spreading your risk and you're growing the cluster and continuing to make your place a better value proposition for more employers to grow.
And I want to get into that in a minute. But first, I'd like to highlight, I guess, a couple of maybe dead buffaloes, if continuing the analogy. And two that come to mind, they're different in style or substance. One is, first of all, a lot of the buffaloes are trying to land an out-of-state company. Right. But some of the buffaloes are trying to keep your prestige company from moving. And so in the first category, you have a situation like 38 Studios.
Right.
And then the second one, you have with Rhode Island trying to lure them from Massachusetts. And then giving them $75 million in loan guarantees to move, and then they file for bankruptcy 13 months later. This in notoriously corrupt Rhode Island. And the second one, you have a company like a state like Washington trying to keep its huge employer Boeing, and they give them nearly $9 billion in tax breaks, right, without conditioning it on them continuing to provide employment in Washington, and they lay off 15% of their workforce.
Right.
Can you highlight a little bit about each of those?
Sure. So the 38 Studios, named for the number that Curt Schilling, the former Red Sox pitcher, wore when he was a star athlete, it was a great example of states getting really sloppy, especially during the recession, and hasty, and failing to vet deals carefully enough. If they had really looked carefully at Mr. Schilling and the company that they were going to bet $75 million on, they would have thought twice and three times, because there really wasn't enough of a track record there of successful, video game production. And they would have built in more safeguards to get the money back if the deal failed, and they didn't. And the state actually had to take on some debt to make those payments. I don't know what the outcome of the litigation was, but there were criminal charges filed later.
There was SEC charges. I think ultimately they were on the hook for about $25
million. Okay. All right. That's a big number for a small state.
For a little bang. Yeah.
Yeah. And then in Puget Sound in Seattle with Boeing, King County there, Snohomish counties, obviously this is a big employer. It's been there for a very long time, big global customer base, big supplier base of other firms making things that go into the planes they assemble there. And they've actually twice gotten big subsidy packages from the state, once for the 787 Dreamliner back in 2003, worth about $3 billion, and then again in 2013 for the 777 product line, worth $8.7 billion. two different governors, two different Democratic governors, two different state legislatures, same kind of result. And they ran public multi-state auctions to gin up pressure on Washington State in each case before getting those packages. And also in the latter case, also making big concessions demands on the bargaining units, the machinists and engineers bargaining units at the factories. The trouble, as you explained, though, with both deals, but especially the last deal, is that they didn't put any kind of safeguard in place that says, in addition to us not taxing this new product line, the 777 that you're going to promise to build in our state, we want you to commit to keeping your headcount reasonably stable here, your overall headcount, including lots of people that make things besides the 777.
Right.
And they didn't. And so jumping through that loophole, the company has laid off a lot of people, moved a lot of jobs to other states, and still is on track to get the big package.
Yeah, that, and I think there's some effort to claw it back, but it really was an embarrassment.
There's been proposed legislation to hold them accountable. I mean, we actually testified on this. One of our staff people who used to work from Seattle, we pointed out that in three of the biggest states, California, Missouri, and I forget the third state, to which they had moved facilities or have other subsidized facilities, Boeing is subject to statewide headcount maintenance requirements. So it's not like something they don't know how to deal with.
Well, that's pouring salt in the wound. So getting back to what localities should do, mm-hmm. in how they should respond to these type of offers, your article, which was co-authored with a professor from the University of North Carolina, really cited the whole North Carolina Raleigh Research Triangle area and Austin as examples of jurisdictions that got it right. Well, why was that?
Yeah, and so it was Dr. Marianne Feldman was my co-author from the University of North Carolina at the Kennan Business School there. And the point we were making is that if you look at places like the Research Triangle there in North Carolina or Austin, Texas, for us, the smart takeaway is that they invested in public goods that benefited lots of young companies in supporting their engineering skills base and supporting their technology development base, and really bridged the public-private sector gap in a way that wasn't buffalo hunting. It was the antithesis of buffalo hunting, was saying, look, we think we've got comparative advantages in the case of Austin and, you know, computer sciences with Dell already here up in Round Rock and some other promising things going on. We'll keep at one point Hewlett-Packard, to its credit, actually turned down a big package from Texas and said, no, take that money and give it to UT's engineering school, and then we'll hire a bunch of brainiacs when they graduate. And that's what they did, and they thrived. And Marianne is very familiar with this. She's an expert in the history of entrepreneurship and how, you know, regional clusters develop. And that's her takeaway too. If you look at the long-term picture, the smart takeaway is avoid the mega deals, invest in things that benefit promising clusters of emerging companies.
And related to that, North Carolina is a hybrid for two points. One is this point, and Austin as well, is the idea of focusing on your comparative edge. But there's also a larger point of the need for investment in infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And, North Carolina, I think going back to the 60s or 70s and the, you know, Governor Terry Sanford, who later became Senator Sanford, mm-hmm. developed a plan to kind of take the state out of, you know, a backwater place and into making it a major, you know, center of industry, and largely through investment in education and in infrastructure, making, for example, UNC right now is one of the phrase is called public Ivies,
yep.
You know, public institutions that are, you know, are as good as or even better than some of the Ivy League schools, and University of North Carolina is one of them. And another one is, you know, here in California, four of the top 10 public Ivies are from what they call the UC system, University of California system. You have mm-hmm. actually number one is last ranking I saw was UCLA, mm-hmm. followed by, you know, Berkeley, UC Santa Barbara, and also UC Irvine. And I looked at some data provided by the UC system, and which includes 61 Nobel laureates. For every dollar that taxpayers invest in them, it results in $9.80 in gross state product and a 13 $1.80 in overall economic output. And so it's a recognition that this investment is just that. It's an investment. It will yield something.
Yeah, I think there's no coincidence that California is home to Silicon Valley because of the state's rich historical investment in its public university systems. You know, obviously there's other things that helped make that happen, especially in the Bay Area, with the history of wealth there and therefore venture capital being available. But it really was kind of a virtuous cycle of robust public investment in your sciences and engineering schools, the availability of venture capital to help commercialize some of the new technology getting developed, and then just building on that. And very similar story with the Research Triangle in North Carolina, where you've had a history, as you said, beginning under Governor Sanford, of a philosophy saying we're not going to do big buffalo hunting, we're not going to cut these extremely expensive one-offs. We're going to have great schools. We're going to try to grow our public Ivy university into a world-class institution and make it attractive for lots of companies to be here. And there's been bumps in the road. They veered away from that for a while, especially in the 90s, starting in the late 90s with a thing called the William S. Lee Act. But that kind of actually libertarian-flavored philosophy of economic development, I think, has served North Carolina well.
And we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk more about what states should do after these messages. You're listening to Cyber Law and Business Report only on webmasterradio.fm.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
It's time once again to get ready for the 35th Annual Miami Book Fair, November 11th through the 18th. Learn more at miamibookfair.com. Over 500 authors will be coming in from all over the world to read their books, answer questions from the audience, and sign autographs. Award-winning luminaries confirmed to attend this year include novelists like Elliot Ackerman, Robert Olin Butler, Ingrid Rojas Contreras, and Deborah Dean. Nonfiction writers like Dr. Mark Agronin, Muhammad Al-Samawi, Andrea Barnett, and Tina Brown. Celebrities like Justine Bateman, Steve Kornacki, Bill Press. These are just a few of the confirmed 500 authors scheduled to appear at the 2018 Miami Book Fair, November 11th to the 18th. Check out the full schedule of events right now at miamibookfair.com. That's miamibookfair.com.
Do you look at the task of ranking your site at the top of the search engines like you would climbing the top of Mount Everest? It doesn't have to be. TopSEOs.com knows how hard that climb can be, and they can make top ranking a reality. TopSEOs sends you to only the right search vendors and agencies that they know will work for you. Since 2002, TopSEOs.com has reviewed and researched the best search engine marketing agencies and solutions providers. Don't risk the cost of falling off the proverbial peak of search rankings. Let TopSEOs give you peace of mind. TopSEOs.com, the independent authority on search vendors.
A more refreshing kind of talk radio.
WebmasterRadio.fm. We're everywhere.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on WebmasterRadio.fm.
And we're back, and we're talking with Greg Leroy, Good Jobs First. And before we continue, just a reminder that there is a background on Greg and his accomplishments on our blog, as always, at cyberlawradio.wordpress.com. Follow us on Twitter at Cyberlaw Radio. In addition, you may have heard the ad for the Miami Book Fair, and that season is now upon us. We're going to be interviewing a number of authors from the book fair, including Rumana Ahmed of West Wingers, James Miller, Can Democracy Work?, Miriam Powell, The Browns of California, and Bill Press, Trump Must Go, Alyssa Court of Squeezed, and that's just a few. So we're looking forward to that season being upon us. But right now we're talking about states or localities that get it right in terms of negotiating with tech and building a tech friendly environment. And one area that we focus a lot on in this show and has been Chattanooga, Tennessee. And they actually grew by investing in a smart grid that gave them what may still be the fastest internet in the U.S. in its first 5 years yield $1 billion in economic benefit and as many as 5,200 new jobs. And what do you think of a model like Chattanooga that decides to, you know, it had a well-educated workforce to begin with, mm-hmm. and decides to invest and jumpstart its economy through infrastructure?
I think it was terrific. I mean, there's lots to love about the Chattanooga story. In addition to the municipal broadband upgrade that they did, you know, they had been reinvesting in their waterfront. They had been reclaiming their downtown. They had been promoting transit-oriented development and housing upgrades. And I think it was all of one piece, but they realized that they could get a leg up by having high-speed internet. And, you know, certainly if you, there's other groups out there like the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, ILSR.org on the web, very active in the space of promoting municipal broadband or community-based, you know, internet access upgrades. And I think it's a very smart strategy because obviously it's the future. Lots more businesses can, people can telecommute, you can do remote marketing and web-based sales and so forth. And it's obviously can't, if it's done well, if it's affordable, it can be an enormous way to break down the so-called digital divide, especially between communities of color that have denied them this robust access to the benefits of internet access. So, you know, I think we need to think of the internet the same way we think of sewer, water, and roads and schools. It is a public right. We should all have access to it. It should be affordable for everybody.
I mean, at the same time, it's interesting, the very same day that the Obama FCC voted to pass its net neutrality measure, it also voted on a provision that would have preempted state laws that prohibit investment in broadband by municipalities. And what you saw after Chattanooga and a number of other jurisdictions started launching their own municipal broadband is that the cable telcos decided to go to the state legislatures and use their muscle to get those shut down or prohibit further investment in broadband. And so the FCC tried to preempt those state laws, including North Carolina's and Tennessee's, that would have done that, and they ultimately that got reversed in court. So it's an interesting thing, whereas the very same people looking for largesse from the state capitals are also trying to prevent competition at the same time. Now, we only have a short bit of time left, and I want to go in some of the measures that you also suggest states consider as a way to prevent what's often referred to as a race to the bottom. I thought one was interesting was in Kansas City, a bi-state ceasefire agreement. Explain how that worked.
Sure. So, beginning 7 years ago, a group of 17 prominent business leaders in the Kansas City metro area, led by the Hall family, who are Hallmark Card Company, 7 years ago, they began yelling publicly at then-Governor Nixon of Missouri and then-Governor Brownback of Kansas, saying, you know, there's these companies that keep jumping back and forth across the state line here in the Kansas City metro area. You keep giving them, you know, eight-figure subsidy packages. They're not really creating any new jobs. They're just changing people's commuting patterns and cashing in when you do that for them. Quit it. You know, we're getting ripped off. This isn't fair. And in 2014, they actually prevailed upon the Missouri legislature, which was led a majority Republican in both houses, and the Democratic Governor Nixon to make enact a legally binding offer that then went to Brownback, who had the power in his state to reciprocate administratively if he so chose. And the offer said, if within 2 years from mid-2014 you agree to this, we will carve out that Kansas City metro area on both sides and say you don't get paid to just jump the state line and change people's commuting patterns. We're going to grow the area, but we're not going to pay people to just move around. And to his discredit, and I don't know why, there was never much explained, Brownback let the offer die in 2016.
He has not, and he's now in his final months as governor, and he very unpopular governor, so who knows why he did that. Another thing you suggest is, the two, I guess, probably go together. One is to cap subsidies at a per job amount. And the other is really a public, you know, having this in public, a debate over this, have it be required that these things be publicly disclosed and debated.
Right. So we've been very big fans of disclosure for a long time, and we've actually made a lot of progress on that front. We at GoodJobs first started issuing so-called report card studies on how well or how poorly state governments disclosed their economic development awards online, that is company-specific, you know, deal-specific records of how much the deal cost and how the deal's playing out over time. And whereas fewer than half used to disclose 12 years ago when we started doing that, today all the states have, to some degree, disclosing their deals online. There's still lots of room for improvement, but we've really made a big progress, and we collect all that data and put it in a big database on our website called Subsidy Tracker. Then this debate, you know, we need to go back, because Uncle Sam is nowhere missing in action here. As a lawyer, you could look it up. There's a case called Daimler Chrysler v. Cuno, a Supreme Court case, an appealing of a decision from the Sixth Circuit out of Toledo, Ohio, in which Cuno v. Daimler Chrysler was ruled that the state of Ohio was interfering with the commerce of Michigan. It's a commerce clause under the U.S. Constitution. Ohio interfered with Michigan's commerce by paying Daimler Chrysler to build a new factory in Toledo, Ohio. The Supreme Court did not rule on the substance of the case. They threw it out on standing, unfortunately, but the oral arguments were excruciating, and I think the good guys would have lost if they had ruled on the Commerce Clause issues. So we haven't had a debate, for example, among the National Governors Association on this issue for 25 years. They refuse to discuss the issue. And occasionally we have rogue governors like Rick Perry visiting California and five other states back in 2013, you know, self-promoting his advance candidacy by radio and TV ads and trying to pirate jobs to Texas. This is no way to run a country. This is no way to have industrial policy.
But it did, for example, in California, it was noted, for example, when Schwarzenegger was governor and there were salary caps at the UC systems, that some of the professors were going to UT, they were going to UNC, and that basically we are not investing in our jewels would lead them to them being taken away.
Well, then look, this is a long-term legacy of Proposition 13, and there's obviously a large body of research and advocacy around this, especially I think from smart groups like the Public Policy Institute of California. You know, the long-term legacy of Proposition 13 has been to artificially depress the amount of revenue available to maintain your jewels there in California. And I know there's debates about possibly amending the law in a way on the 2020 ballot there, and I welcome everybody's attention to that proposal because it would begin to fix some of the problems. I don't think it's fair to let some companies be sitting on really old assessed valuations and new companies paying full freight for today's values. That's just not fair to anybody, frankly, and especially not fair to everybody who wants great schools and infrastructure.
Right. And we only have 2 minutes left. If people want to learn more about Good Jobs First and you, what's the best place for them to go?
Yeah, goodjobsfirst.org. That's all one word, and first is spelled out.
And do you have any upcoming events or reports that you want to highlight?
We do. We're about to issue a study. So we won this obscure accounting rule called GASB Statement 77 on tax abatement disclosures. It's a rule that says most local and state governments have to finally report how much revenue they lose to these corporate tax break programs. So we're going to issue a study looking at how much revenue has been lost to school districts all around the country thanks to this new disclosure rule. And it's a lot. Spoiler alert, it's a big number.
Wow. All right. We'll look forward to that. Thank you very much for joining us. It's been a pleasure. It's a very important debate to have. And so I want to thank you again. In addition, I want to extend our condolences to the Georgetown law community on the passing of former Dean Robert Potofsky. He was also a former chairman of twice of the Federal Trade Commission and a giant in antitrust law. So our condolences to him and his family and the Georgetown community. But we will be back next week with another edition of Cyber Law and Business Report. Until then, check us out on the web at cyberlawradio.com, as well as our blog, cyberlawradio.wordpress.com, and follow us on Twitter at cyberlawradio. Also, check out the Internet Law Center at internetlawcenter.net. Thank you again, and look forward to talking to you next week. Go Red Sox. Bye.
The opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and hosts and do not necessarily reflect those of WebmasterRadio.fm's management or sponsors. Any rebroadcast or redistribution without authorized consent of WebmasterRadio.fm is prohibited.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.